Hundred that would fly at 100,000 feet at Mach 2.5 with a 3,000-mile range. The body was enormous, dwarfing any airplane on the drawing boards. On the playing field at Yankee Stadium, for example, the tail would cover home plate, and the nose nudge the right field foul pole 296 feet away. It was more than twice the size of the B-52 bomber. And the reason the body was so gigantic was that it would carry a fuel load of liquid hydrogen weighing 162,850 pounds, making it the world's largest thermos bottle. Flying at more than twice the speed of sound, the outer shell of the body would blaze from heat friction above 350 degrees Fahrenheit, while the inside skin would hold the frosty fuel at temperatures of minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit, an 800-degree temperature differential that represented an awesomely complicated thermodynamic problem. Undaunted, Kelly promised to have a prototype ready in 18 months. The Air Force allocated $96 million, and we were off and running. The code name was Suntan, and it was classified above top secret. That was a first even for us. Only 25 people at the Skunk Works were cleared to work on it, and around the time that the U-2 overflights of Russia revealed that no bomber gap existed, the CIA dropped a bombshell by presenting Eisenhower with strong indications that the Russians were crashing development of a hydrogen-powered airplane of their own. They had released from a Siberian gulag a brilliant scientist named Pyotr Kapitsa, who had been arrested by Stalin in 1946 for refusing to work on their atomic bomb development. Kapitsa was Russia's foremost expert on liquid hydrogen. He was now back in Moscow working on a top-secret program. Alan Dulles and Dick Bissell agreed that it was likely the Russians were rushing development of a liquid hydrogen-propelled interceptor that could easily climb to the U-2's heights and shoot it down. The CIA came to Kelly and asked his opinion. "They might be working their tails off to get this airplane into production," he told Dulles, "but they won't have a prototype finished in less than 3 years, or even longer." So suddenly we found ourselves in a contest with the Russians to build the first hydrogen-powered airplane. The Air Force contracted with Pratt & Whitney to build the engines at its Florida complex, and a special hydrogen liquefaction plant was constructed to fuel the engine tests. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology was working on an inertial guidance system, and Kelly ordered 2.5 miles of aluminum extrusions in advance of construction. But 6 months into the project, the furrows deepened on Kelly's brow. He was growing increasingly concerned that the airplane would not have adequate range to get the job done. "We've crammed the fuselage with as much fuel as it can hold," he complained at our weekly progress meeting, "and we can't extend the range by more than 2,500 miles. The problem was complicated by the fact that the Air Force engineers at Wright Field had come up with wildly more optimistic figures. They predicted a range of 3,500 miles, which was more than acceptable, matching the U-2s. Kelly stepped up design changes and wind tunnel testing of various wooden models, but remained convinced that Wright Field's calculations were dead wrong. Meanwhile, I was having troubles of my own. Inside a hangar, I built a half-scale model of the fuselage and constructed a double-walled fuel tank. I wanted to simulate supersonic flight temperatures, so I installed a wooden-framed oven over the fuselage to heat it to 350 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And on a clammy spring evening in late 1959, the damn stove caught on fire only a few feet away from a storage tank containing 700 gallons of liquid hydrogen. We tried to put the fire out with commercial fire extinguishers, but they had little effect. I sure as hell was reluctant to call the Burbank Fire Department and have them discover all that liquid hydrogen. I thought fast and told the workers, "Okay, dump that damned hydrogen. Bleed that tank dry." By now, the hangar was filled with smoke and flames were visible above the model fuselage. The workers looked at me funny but did what I told them. And on that damp evening, the cold hydrogen filled that hangar with a fog 5 feet thick. All we could see of one another were our heads. If it wasn't for the fire, we might have had a good laugh. But the fire department noisily arrived at our hangar door, and the next problem was that security didn't want to let them in. The firemen weren't cleared, and this was a project above top secret. I couldn't believe the stupidity but I took one of the security guys aside and said the whole place is under fog. They won't see what's on fire. What is inside? The fire chief asked me. National security stuff. Can't tell you, I replied. The firemen saw the fog and went running for their gas masks. Had they known we were playing around with liquid hydrogen so close to Burbank Airport, I'm sure they would have had my scalp. But they put out the fire in 2 minutes and went away, no questions asked. But Kelly was cranky with me. God damn it, Rich, why in hell did you use a damned wooden-framed stove? That was just asking for trouble. I told him he was nickel and diming me so severely on this project that a wooden-framed stove was all I could afford. He couldn't argue. God knows how many hours I spent as part of a small team sitting in Kelly's office, reviewing all our data and trying desperately to pull a few range-extending tricks out of the bag. We knew damned well what the problems were. We missed our lift-over-drag ratio by 16% from what we originally had estimated. And our specific fuel consumption was disappointing, too. We thought we would be able to achieve 1/5 the fuel consumption of a standard kerosene-fueled engine at Mach 2.5. Instead, we were able to achieve only 1/4 the fuel consumption. Not good enough to get us where we needed to go and back. The only way to extend range was by improving fuel consumption, adding more fuel storage capacity, and improving lift-over drag to make the airplane fly more efficiently. We had done all that we could in each of these critical areas and were still 1,000 miles short of our guarantee to the Air Force. Since I was his expert on the exotic fuel, Kelly asked for my opinion. I said, 2,000 miles will only get us from Los Angeles to Omaha. We would have to land at a base that stored liquid hydrogen for us to refuel. Air-to-air refueling is out, so we would need strategically placed liquid hydrogen tank farms in Europe and Asia to refuel our airplane on its flights over Russia, leaving us with the nightmare problems of logistics and handling of a touchy, volatile fuel. Right now, we are having huge headaches shipping in our special fuel to our U-2 base in Turkey, and that does not require special refrigeration and expert handling. Kelly sighed and said he agreed with me. He picked up the phone and called Secretary of the Air Force James Douglas, Jr. Mr. Secretary, he said, I'm afraid I'm building you a dog. My recommendation is that we cancel Suntan and send you back your money as soon as possible. We don't have the range to justify this project. It took several Pentagon meetings with Kelly before the Air Force reluctantly agreed with him. We had spent about $6 million in development costs and returned $90 million to the government. The punchline to the story is this. Not long after the contract was canceled, the Soviets launched their Sputnik 1 into orbit. The rocket engine that had carried it into space was hydrogen-fueled. The engine builder was Pyotr Kapitsa, who had been released from the Gulag not to build an airplane, but to launch Sputnik. We had all guessed wrong. But our exercise on the hydrogen airplane was not a total waste. General Dynamics was working on a hydrogen-powered rocket called Centaur, so we turned over to them all our cryostats and liquid hydrogen pumps. We in the Skunk Works had proved to ourselves that we could develop a large supersonic airplane and engine. Even before Powers was shut down, Kelly had determined that we would need to make a quantum leap in technology in order to keep our spy planes operational over Russia. Within months, we would be planning a technological marvel called the Blackbird as successor to the U-2. Once again, we'd be teamed with Dick Bissell and the CIA and challenged to produce a new miracle. Postscript on the U-2. All through the escapades involving the hydrogen airplane, the main occupation inside the Skunk Works was maintaining the production line of new U-2s. Many Americans believe that the U-2 died the day the Powers was shut down. The CIA did, in fact, close down its secret bases overseas and come home. But we had sold more than 20 U-2s to the Air Force back in the late 1950s, and more than twice that number since then. And there never has been a single day since that airplane became operational in 1956 that a U-2 isn't flying somewhere in the world on a surveillance operation for the Blue Suiters, NASA, or the Drug Enforcement Agency. In fact, on more than one occasion over the years, the U-2 may have saved the world from thermonuclear war. Although Eisenhower decreed the end to Soviet overflights after the Powers tragedy, The Blue Suiters very soon began flying U-2s along the Soviet border using new technologies like side-looking radar, which could peer 200 miles or more inside Russia, and carrying special electronic packages that could capture all the different military band and radar frequencies used by the Soviet Defense Forces, helping us to build effective jamming devices in the event of hostilities. In many ways, this electronic intelligence collecting was even more valuable than the photo-taking operations of old. Around the time that Eisenhower left office in 1960, Dick Bissell and the CIA were teamed with Lockheed's Missiles and Space Company to put up the first spy-in-the-sky satellite. A satellite was locked into its orbit, but a U-2 could overfly any trouble spot on Earth in a few hours. And we never stopped improving the airplane. We invented a novel interchangeable nose that could be unscrewed and unbolted in less than an hour and replaced for a particular mission. Some noses carrying radar, some cameras, some air sampling filters, some electronic devices recording radar and military traffic frequencies, some operating a special rotating camera that could follow the flight path of a Soviet-launched test missile. Other flights carried a heavy payload of electronic eavesdropping equipment. By monitoring their test missile firings, we discovered the frequencies used by their missiles locking to a target. We used this information to counter with powerful jamming devices installed in our attack aircraft. One unforeseen consequence of the powered shootdown was to make U-2 overseas bases a political hot potato for our host country allies, allowing us to take off and land on their soil. The Russians were frothing at the mouth at the mention of the U-2. Threatening dire reprisals, including air attacks, against any country hosting a U-2 base. As pressures built, both Japan and Turkey capitulated and asked us to fold our tents. To become more self-sufficient, we decided to develop an air-to-air refueling capacity for the U-2, extending its range to roam very far from home on spy missions. It would also allow us to do more low-level flying to avoid radar detection, which was very fuel-inefficient. Refueling could extend the U-2's range to 7,000 nautical miles and 14 straight hours of flying time, which pushed a pilot's fatigue beyond safety. The U-2s could receive 900 gallons of fuel from a KC-135 tanker in about 5 minutes. But most U-2 pilots agreed with our test pilot, Bill Park, who flew the first extended-range mission and sighed, "Never again. My mind went numb 10 minutes ahead of my ass." The Army wanted to use the U-2 for battlefield surveillance. As for the Navy, Kelly had polished off a bottle of White Horse up at Edwards Air Force Base with a couple of old pal Air Force generals, one of whom had bet him that the Navy would never buy a U-2 because the airplane could not take off from a carrier deck. "You don't have the horses to get into the air," one general challenged Kelly, who got sore and told the general he didn't know what in hell he was talking about. Then the three of them staggered out of the officers' club and paced out the length of a carrier deck on the main runway at Edwards. Later that day, they got a U-2 to take off. Kelly won his bet with ease. And so the Navy was interested in purchasing the U-2 for its own reconnaissance uses, including extended-range anti-submarine patrols. Also through the CIA, we completed a deal with the Chinese Nationalist Government on Taiwan, selling them several U-2s for $6 million, along with the services of our ground crews and technicians. Kelly signed the contract for us, and Chiang Kai-shek signed for the Taiwanese. But the Nationalist government had nothing to do with the operation except to provide pilots. The CIA was in charge and in control of the operation. They would be overflying Communist China from Formosa, and were called Detachment H. This operation was one of the most tightly held secrets in the government. We began training 6 of their pilots. I remember briefing them on the U-2's propulsion system at Burbank in the summer of 1959. On one of the training flights from the ranch, a Taiwanese pilot flamed out over Cortez, Colorado, and was forced to glide into a small county airport around dusk. The airport manager took one look and almost fainted. The airplane was one that he had never seen before, long and sleek with enormous wings. Then the canopy opened and out stepped an alien in a spacesuit, with only almond-shaped eyes visible through his visor. who ran to him, shouting in very garbled English, "Quick! Get gun! Guard plane! Very, very secret!" The Taiwanese squadron, which became known as the Black Cats, was a joint CIA-Taiwanese operation flying from Taoyuan Airfield, just south of Taipei. These U-2 flights over Red China lasted for more than 14 years, from late in 1959 until 1974, when President Nixon finally put a stop to them in deference to his new diplomatic opening to the People's Republic. But especially during the early 1960s, the overflights were considered by the intelligence community to be extremely urgent. "We needed hard information on Chinese nuclear and missile development." The Pentagon was particularly eager to learn how the Sino-Soviet split was affecting China's military capacity and its weapons procurements. The flights were much more grueling and dangerous than the Soviet overflights. Typical 8 to 10 hour missions, calling for a 3,000-mile flight over hostile territory, practically from takeoff to landing. To reach the highest priority targets of nuclear test sites in northwestern China and the Chuchuan Intermediate Ballistic Missile Range in Gansu Province meant flying 12-hour round trips. Over the years, as Chinese ground-to-air missile defenses improved, the Taiwanese took a pounding. 4 U-2s were shot down and their pilots lost. During the 60s, the remains of those downed airplanes were put on display in downtown Peking, and the overflights so enraged the communist Chinese, they offered $250,000 in gold to the Taiwanese pilot who would defect with a U-2 to the mainland. And no wonder, the intelligence acquired by these flights was so revealing that U.S. experts were able to accurately predict when the Chinese would finally test their first nuclear weapon in October 1964. Back in Burbank, we did what we could to help cut down the U-2 losses. We developed improved electronic countermeasures, ECM, calculated to confuse Chinese radar operators working their SA-2 ground-to-air missile systems. On radar screens, the U-2 would present a false display so that the missile would be launched in the wrong piece of sky. Our ECM package was bulky and heavy and cost around 200 gallons of fuel-carrying capacity, cutting into range and altitude performance. Some of the more distant nuclear test sites near the Tibetan border were out of range of the Taiwan-based U-2s. To cover these targets, the agency flew from dirt landing strips in India and Pakistan on an ad hoc basis. In fact, 3 months before Powers was shot down over Russia, a CIA pilot flew from a secret base in Thailand against Chinese nuclear facilities. The U-2 dropped a javelin spike that we had dreamed up that contained special miniature seismic sensors to record an expected thermonuclear bomb test. Unfortunately, we never got any data back and never learned why. But the pilot on that mission was forced to crash land short of his base in Thailand and came down in a rice paddy. He was able to negotiate a deal with the village head man. The villagers helped him to cut up the U-2 and put the pieces aboard ox carts and haul it to a clearing, where a CIA C-124 landed the next day and took him and his plane out. In return, the agency paid the headman $500 to build a schoolhouse. Gary Powers should have been so lucky. Other voices. Buddy Brown. "I was just a dumb 23-year-old fighter jock, which is exactly what the Air Force was looking for back in 1957. All they told me was, 'How would you like to fly at very high altitude in a pressure suit?' I immediately thought, 'Rocket ships! Buck Rogers! Count me in!' I was shipped down to Laughlin Air Force Base in Del Rio, Texas, on the Mexican border, way out of sight, which is how the Air Force wanted it, because it wasn't until the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis that the world learned the Air Force was flying U-2s. We had 20 airplanes there and Air Force instructors to check us out, but we had a lot of fatalities. The U-2 was strictly a one-seater. The first time you flew it, you soloed, ready or not. We did a lot of landing pattern and takeoff practicing and got up to 60,000 feet to get the feel of our pressure suits. It was a very tricky airplane, and we had a lot of fatal pilot errors. One guy was killed flying over his house while showing off for his wife and two little boys. He banked too low and slammed into a hill. Another time, the squadron commander was forced to eject when his flap switch stuck and he lost his tail and we didn't have an ejection seat. So he jumped out, making the highest bailout ever, a record 55,000 feet, and was very badly hurt. Another time I watched a guy nose in on landing and kill himself. I shit because I had to fly next. My first assignment was the most dangerous flying I had ever done, by far. I flew out of Alaska in what was officially called the High Altitude Sampling Program. That meant flying into the drifting radioactive clouds following Soviet and Chinese nuclear tests. Up there on polar flights when the sky was crystal clear and you could see the curvature of the Earth, you'd be able to spot the nasty-looking iodine cloud drifting from God knows how many miles off, and we'd fly right into it. That program was entirely Air Force and every bit as important as the agency flights over Russia. We flew for the Defense Atomic Support Agency, which collected our 6 bottles of gaseous samples of particulates after each flight and rushed them back to Washington for laboratory analysis. They could tell by debris samples carried in the wind whether the Chinese exploded an air or ground burst, what part of the country it was set off in, how advanced their trigger and weapon were just by the materials that vaporized. And we always knew their tests from our own, because we placed a tiny metal object in our nuclear devices that left an unmistakable signature on a spectroscope. We figured we were pretty safe from radiation hazards while insulated in a pressure suit. But we were naive about the dangers in those days. The most penetrating radiation was believed to decay so quickly that by the time we flew into a cloud of gases and suspended debris, the risks were supposedly minimal. We wore radiation badges. Still, every so often, an aircraft landed very damn hot and had to be isolated and washed down, and the pilot spent the night in hospital as a precaution. As far as I know, no one was the worst for it. We flew these sampling missions every Tuesday and Thursday, in conjunction with other blue suitors flying U-2s in Puerto Rico and Argentina, taking an opposite route from us. So we had one north and one south mission, and in that way we were able to sample half the globe per mission. I flew some sampling missions out of Laverton, which was the Australian version of Edwards Air Force Base, flying toward Antarctica. I was more fearful then than I was later flying U-2 reconnaissance flights in combat over Vietnam. The reason was the extreme weather. You'd last 2 seconds if forced to bail out in those awful temperatures, and you'd last 5 minutes on the ground. The distances were so vast, there was no way to be rescued in time. I flew at a time when the Chinese were exploding a lot of nukes, so I got used to 10-hour missions. I drank a pint and a half of orange juice through my feeding hole in my helmet, but even so, after a long flight, my fingernails were so brittle from body dehydration that I could just crack them off. We also worried that ozone from so much high-altitude flying would rot our teeth. Maybe that was an old wives' tale, but we all worried about it. I got the base dentist to make me a set of rotten-looking greenish false teeth to wear over my real teeth at base parties. I also flew a lot of what we called peripheral missions, flying just outside the borders of the Soviet Union or China, collecting intelligence. All I had to do was throw a switch and recorders on board would collect the bad guys' radar frequencies and signals and monitor everything. I remember one particular mission, codenamed Congo Maiden, where we had 5 U-2s up there at the same time in the northern part of the Soviet Union. We carried on board an ECM package called a System 12, so you knew when you were being picked up by Soviet radar by hearing pings in your headset. Tightened my sphincter for sure. I flew Vietnam missions out of Okinawa as early as 1960. I flew over the Plain of Jars and watched the French get their butts kicked by Uncle Ho. Then, in 62, the Russians took a few shots at me with SA-2s during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Didn't come close thanks to my black box in the tail that jammed effectively. So I'm a believer. But that was inconsequential compared to another blue suitor U-2 pilot, Major Chuck Maltsby, who was flying out of Alaska on a routine sampling mission right at the height of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. His mission took him over the North Pole in the middle of the night, and when he turned to return to Alaska, He took the wrong south heading and wound up flying deep into Soviet territory. The Russians picked him up right away and thought SAC was coming in the back way to nuke them and start World War III. We monitored them scrambling jets against Chuck. He could see the contrails of dozens of fighters trying to reach his altitude and shoot him down. Finally, President Kennedy got on the hotline with Khrushchev and told him, "We have a lost U-2 pilot over your country on a weather mission, and he is not, repeat, not a hostile aircraft." Maltzby had no direct radio communications, only a passive HF receiver that allowed him to listen. Someone on the tanker that had refueled him got on the horn and informed Chuck that it was sunrise over Alaska and suggested he turn his airplane 90 degrees until he saw light, then fly in that direction. Chuck obeyed and headed for the western tip of Alaska, where he was met by a couple of our F-106s that escorted him to base. He had made the longest U-2 flight ever, about 15 straight hours, and ran his fuel down to zero, flamed out, had to dead stick in with his face mask all frosted over. The CIA had been covering Cuba with U-2 flights for years. And then in August 1962, they hit pay dirt and came up with the pictures that showed the Russians were planting ballistic missiles right next door, SS-4s and SS-5s. When Kennedy was shown the site constructions, he asked, "How do we know these sites are being manned?" They showed Kennedy a picture taken from 72,000 feet, showing a worker taking a dump in an outdoor latrine. The picture was so clear you could see that guy reading a newspaper. The first thing Kennedy did was to step up the flights. The second thing he did was to take the agency off the case and put in us blue suiters in their place. If a guy was shot down, he wanted it to be a military driver, not a CIA employee. So I was one of 8 Air Force guys who took over the Cuban overflights during the crisis. We flew out of McCoy Air Force Base in Florida, 3 or 4 missions a day. Since our missions were relatively short, we carried less fuel, and so we could climb higher than usual, which was good because some of these missions got hairy. On October 27th, one of our guys, Major Rudy Anderson, got nailed when an SA-2 missile fired from a Cuban naval base at the eastern end of the island exploded above and to the rear. Shrapnel blasted into Rudy's canopy and blew holes into him. It was standard procedure to brief a primary and backup mission pilot for each day's mission. The morning Rudy was hit by a SAM, I was flying the primary mission area, while Rudy was scheduled to fly the backup mission if my area was weathered in. As it turned out, my area was completely socked in with clouds, so Rudy flew the backup mission and got hit. One of the more awful aspects to this tragedy happened during a training accident earlier in the year. A pilot named Campbell was killed during a refueling exercise back in California. A garbled message got back to Edwards Base Control Tower that Anderson was the pilot killed, and everyone rushed over to Rudy's house to comfort his wife, Jane. Well, you can imagine the impact on Jane until the phone rang and she heard Rudy's voice and then damn near fainted away. Then she was forced to go through the same shit the second time only 8 months later, but this time for real. After Rudy was shot down, we got the word that Kennedy had warned Castro and Khrushchev that if another reconnaissance airplane was shot down, we would stage an all-out bombing attack against these installations. The rumor was he was prepared to nuke the island. If we heard that rumor, figure the Cubans did too. I was selected to fly to Homestead Air Force Base in Florida and brief President Kennedy on the Cuban missions. When I was introduced to the president, he smiled and remarked, "Major Brown, you take damn good pictures." Ben Rich. In late 1963, we began launching U-2s from U.S. aircraft carriers, having developed a workable tailhook. In May 1964, the U-2 took off from the USS Ranger to monitor French nuclear tests in an atoll in French Polynesia, but only after one of our test pilots, Bob Schumacher, crashed while landing on deck. We had the airplane fixed and flying by the next morning. The target of the operation was Mururoa Atoll, a part of French Polynesia. We monitored all of their testing, and the French never knew we were observing them. The flights were secret, and the carrier crew had to go below deck when the bird took off and landed. The agency painted on its tail, Office of Naval Research. just in case it was forced to crash land in French territory. The photographic evidence acquired by the overflights revealed that de Gaulle's government would be ready for full-scale nuclear weapons production in a year. During the Vietnam War, we launched gliders from our U-2s as decoys, a Kelly Johnson idea. The gliders carried tiny transmitters that fooled the North Vietnamese missile batteries into thinking they were actually B-52 bombers or fighter bombers. So, for $500 a decoy, we forced them to launch missiles, costing thousands of dollars. Other voices. James R. Schlesinger, Director of the CIA, 1973, Secretary of Defense, 1973-75. As Secretary of Defense, I confronted my own version of a Cuban Missile Crisis scenario in the mid-1970s, when I suddenly found myself under enormous political pressure and the U-2 came to my rescue and bailed me out. This happened during the Ford administration in the spring of 1975, a period during which the Soviets were aggressively establishing bases and influence in northeastern Africa, in places like Somalia, Angola, and Uganda. Henry Kissinger, then Secretary of State, was pushing aggressively for détente with the Soviets. He and I were on opposite ends of a tug of war about establishing an American naval base in the Indian Ocean on the British-owned island of Diego Garcia. Kissinger was adamantly opposed to building such a base and had a lot of powerful support for his position in Congress. Democratic Majority Leader Mike Mansfield urged that the entire Indian Ocean region remain a zone of peace that would preclude us from operating there. The dispute with Congress over that base was endless. The Russians also screamed loudly about the provocation of an American naval installation in the Indian Ocean, even though they were crawling all over the place, aggressively extending their influence throughout the region. We had good intelligence on what they were up to in Somalia and Uganda, which were pretty much under their domination. In April, spy satellite photos landed on my desk showing that the Soviets had constructed a missile handling and storage facility at the Somalian port of Berbera, commanding strategic approaches to the Red Sea, which would be a depot for storing Styx missiles used by the Soviet fleet in the Indian Ocean. These were missiles fired against other ships. The pictures provided proof of a Soviet military buildup in the area, but I was stymied by a blanket injunction against any public disclosure of satellite photography, extending even to members of Congress. In those days, we didn't admit that spy satellites existed, so I could not release the pictures, especially to make a political point. Instead, I ordered the Air Force to schedule a U-2 flight over the Berbera installation and provide overhead photos that I could make available to the press. The photos taken by the U-2 were superb, and I decided to go public and announce that the Soviets had begun storing missiles in Somalia. I knew that my announcement would fire a lot of angry skepticism in my direction, among détente proponents on the Hill as well as among some in the press, who heaped scorn on the Pentagon, claiming we were eager to sabotage détente and using scare tactics to overcome congressional opposition to a U.S. base in the Indian Ocean. The Russians and the Somalis vigorously denied my accusation. The Russians claimed they were only building a meatpacking plant at Berbera, and nothing more. Kissinger was concerned that I was about to upset his détente policy, so he was not enamored about having me release the U-2 pictures to the press to prove my contention. To be frank, he was rather infuriated with me over the entire episode, especially when I showed the U-2 pictures to the Senate Armed Services Committee and gave copies to the New York Times, which ran a picture in early June. The Russians called the picture a mirage, intended to win support for a larger Pentagon budget. But for me, the release of those U-2 photos became a jolly good episode. Once again, overhead photography caught the Russians trying to upset strategic balances, just as they had in the Cuban Missile Crisis, by secretly extending their military capabilities on friendly shores. But before that summer ended, the U-2 pictures had nailed our case. The Somali government backed off its futile denials and, trying to save face and win congressional support for drought aid, actually invited us into Berbera to build a naval supply installation of our own. Ben Rich. In August 1970, Henry Kissinger arranged for two U-2s to monitor the unsettled Middle East buffer zone between Israel and Egypt, and in April 1974, after 20 years, the CIA ended its aviation activities and turned over all its 20 remaining U-2 aircraft to the Air Force. In more recent years, the airplane has seen service monitoring the oil leak in the Santa Barbara Channel, the Mount St. Helens eruption, floods, topography, earthquake, and hurricane damage assessments, and by drug enforcement agencies to monitor poppy fields around the globe. The DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, was involved in a test project on the U.S.-Mexican border in the late 1970s to test infrared film filter combinations on poppy fields photographed from high altitudes. Every growing thing has its own infrared signature, and the agents wanted to discover how poppies photographed at various stages in their growth cycle. Photo interpreters could tell how close to harvesting a particular field was. The field in question was in Yuma, Arizona, specially cultivated under the DEA's supervision, using fugitive Mexican poppy planters. A U-2 would overfly the field at various stages in the growth cycle and photograph it. Finally, the agency, after conferring with the Mexican planters, ordered a last flight for photos showing poppies ready to harvest. The U-2 flew over the field as scheduled, only to discover the poppy field had been swept clean. The workers had harvested the crop the night before and slipped back into Mexico. The first U.S. government-subsidized and grown heroin was probably on the streets a few weeks later. When we in the Skunk Works first built the U-2, we thought it would be in production for about 18 months, but it is still in service. During Operation Desert Storm, the U-2 overflights monitored Iraqi tank movements, and its sideband radar proved effective in revealing the presence and configuration of enemy minefields. In January 1993, when the outgoing Bush administration decided to bomb Saddam Hussein's missile batteries in the southern no-fly zone, the U-2 was once again providing the vital intelligence data preliminary to the bombing. On the day before the bombing raid, I received a call at home from an official of the CIA. "Ben," he said, "we just got a call from President-elect Clinton. He wants to know the altitude of the U-2. No one at this end is sure, so I thought I'd go straight to the horse's mouth. Tell the president-elect that our bird flies at 70,000 feet. And I said it with pride. 9. Faster than a speeding bullet. The Blackbird, which dominated our work in the 60s, was the greatest high-performance airplane of the 20th century. Everything about this airplane's creation was gigantic. The technical problems that had to be overcome, the political complexities surrounding its funding, even the ability of the Air Force's most skilled pilots to master this incredible wild horse of the stratosphere. Kelly Johnson rightly regarded the Blackbird as the crowning triumph of his years at the Skunk Works helm. All of us who shared in its creation wear a badge of special pride. Nothing designed and built by any other aerospace operation in the world before or since the Blackbird can begin to rival its speed, height, effectiveness, and impact. Had we built Blackbird in the year 2010, the world would still have been awed by such an achievement. But the first model, designed and built for the CIA as the successor to the U-2, was being test-flown as early as 1962. Even today, that feat seems nothing less than miraculous. Kelly Johnson's disappointment over our failure to produce a workable hydrogen-powered airplane had him pouting for a day or two, but he quickly recovered and began lobbying the CIA for a new spy plane to fly over Russia that would be a quantum leap over the U-2 in every way. He assembled a small group of us who had worked on the hydrogen plane, and had us brainstorming ideas for new designs and approaches for an airplane that used conventional engines and fuel, but still could outrace any Russian missile. "It makes no sense," he said, "to just take this one or two steps ahead, because we'd be buying only a couple of years before the Russians would be able to nail us again. No, I want us to come up with an airplane that can rule the skies for a decade or more." At that point in April 1958, the U-2 overflights of Russia were in their second year and going well. In fact, it would be two more years before Francis Gary Powers was shot down, and the high priority at the Skunk Works was Operation Rainbow, our attempt to lower the U-2's radar cross-section. But Kelly declared the U-2 doomed. The Russians had made it a matter of national honor to find a way to stop U-2 overflights and were investing billions of rubles in rushing to develop a missile system to do so. Dick Bissell shared Kelly's glum outlook for the U-2's future and encouraged him to begin sketching out a successor spy plane. "We'll fly at 90,000 feet and jack up the speed to Mach 3. It will have a range of 4,000 miles, Kelly told a group of us. "The higher and faster we fly, the harder it will be to spot us, much less stop us." I didn't know about Richard Bissell of the CIA, but Ben Rich of the Skunk Works reacted to Kelly's idea with jaw-dropping disbelief. He was proposing to build an airplane that would fly not only 4 times faster than the U-2, but 5 miles higher, and the U-2 was then the current high-altitude champion of the skies. A Mach 3 airplane was 60% faster than the maximum dash capability of our top-performance jet fighter. Experimental rocket airplanes had flown at blinding Mach 3 speed, using powerful thrusters for 2 or 3 minutes at a time until fuel ran out. But Kelly was proposing an airplane to cruise at more than 3 times the speed of sound, that could fly coast to coast in less than an hour on 1 tank of gas. Kelly's audacious idea would probably not have been taken seriously by the CIA, coming from anyone other than the boss of the Skunk Works. After all, in 1954, we had built the F-104 Starfighter, the world's first Mach 2 fighter. So a Mach 3 airplane seemed a logical extension of our skills. However, there was a Grand Canyon-sized gulf between designing an airplane like the F-104 that could kick in its afterburners on takeoffs and in dash modes lasting a minute or two, and designing an airplane whose normal cruising speed was nearly twice as fast as the fastest fighter's dash speed. On afterburners, a fighter was burning fuel at a rate 4 times faster than at cruise speed, so afterburners were saved for combat threat situations, escaping flak after a bombing run, or outflying missiles or dogfighting MiGs. We were proposing to fly whole missions on afterburners. The technology confronting us was so far beyond anything on the drawing boards of any other aerospace company in the world that we might as well have been proposing commuter rocket service between the moon and the outer ring of planets. For openers, to be able to fly sustained at such heights and speeds would require radical departures in how we designed and built propulsion systems. "Rich," Kelly said, turning my way, "I'm making you program manager for the propulsion system." He ignored my stunned expression. "How hot do you suppose the airplane will get at Mach 3 in sustained flight?" he asked me. "Somewhere between a blowtorch and a soldering iron, I guess," I replied when my voice returned. He nodded. "Probably around 900 degrees at the nose," he said. "Just imagine that kind of thrust. You're the lucky one. You'll at least have known laws of physics to guide you. The rest of us are going to have to do some fancy stretching to find out what can work. We start from scratch as if we are building the first airplane, just like the Wright brothers." If I had been older and smarter, I would have run for the nearest exit. I had to produce a propulsion system more efficient than any other ever designed. I was then only a 32-year-old fledgling still on probation to prove my worth as a propulsion and thermodynamics engineer among many of my senior colleagues. But I was cocky enough to shrug off Kelly's challenge and think, a Mach 3 airplane? Why in hell not? Kelly surrounded himself only with the kind of can-do guys that made American aerospace technology preeminent. To him, the word impossible was a gross insult. Kelly promised to deliver the world's first Mach 3 airplane to the CIA only 20 months after we signed a contract. That also seemed to me and my pathetic innocence a reasonable deadline. After all, it had taken us only 8 quick months to deliver the first U-2. Had I really thought about it, in complexity, the U-2 was to the Blackbird, as a covered wagon was to an Indy 500 race car. To action-oriented guys like Bissell and Kelly, President Eisenhower often moved too cautiously. In pique, they referred to him as Speedy Gonzales, while being forced to cool their heels for weeks or months awaiting Oval Office decisions, whether for approving a particular U-2 mission over Russia or signing off on a new spy plane project. Kelly's airplane was bound to cost millions and would be a tough sell. The president was already spending $1 billion in covert funds on the Agena rocket that would boost our first spy satellite into orbit. Bissell was in charge of that program, too, and the first 12 test firings had all been failures. Lockheed's Missiles and Space Company in Sunnyvale, California, had that contract, and Bissell asked Kelly to evaluate and reorganize their operation. Kelly set up a mini-Skunk Works, and coincidentally or not, the 13th test shot was a success. But spy satellites had distinct limitations. Their pictures in those days were not very sharp, and their orbits were fixed, so the Russians would learn to hide secrets before each scheduled overflight. By contrast, a spy plane operated on no fixed schedules, could loiter in areas of interest, and could overfly tension spots within hours. Our photography was vastly superior to a satellite's. I tremendously valued the U-2 photo takes, but continually worried about the consequences of a shootdown. He was attracted to the satellite alternative because he felt it was a less aggressive and threatening way to obtain overhead intelligence. Nations would learn to live in the age of satellites, but a spy plane flight would always be regarded as a provocative and aggressive violation of a country's territory. So Bissell wisely decided to seek the backing of Ike's two most influential technology advisors, Dr. James Killian, the president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Dr. Edwin Land of Polaroid, who chaired the Presidential Advisory Panel on Aerial Espionage and was the godfather of the U-2 program. In May 1958, Kelly flew to Cambridge to meet with Dr. Land and his associates. At that first meeting, he was amazed to learn that the Navy had its own Rube Goldberg blueprint for a high-flying spy plane. Theirs would be a ramjet, lifted high into the stratosphere by a balloon. At 100,000 feet, the pilot would release the balloon, light booster rockets to get his ramjet started, then roar up to 155,000 feet. A Navy commander presented this unique idea to the panel while Kelly sat scribbling figures on a pad. "By my calculations," Kelly told the group, "in order to lift that ramjet, the Navy's balloon would have to be over 1 mile in diameter. Gentlemen, that's one hell of a lot of hot air." A more serious proposal came from Convair, which had also been solicited by Bissell for ideas on a high-flying, high-speed spy plane. They had built the B-58 Hustler bomber, a highly regarded Mach 2 tactical strike airplane, which they presented as a mothership that would launch a piloted rocket plane that supposedly could reach 125,000 feet at Mach 4. The piggyback launch concept interested Land, but as months passed and the idea was further refined and tested, it became increasingly obvious that the B-58 could not go supersonic while carrying a smaller bird under its belly. Kelly was also skeptical about whether Convair's plan could produce a reliable photo platform, and he wasn't shy in passing along his doubts to his CIA friends. Over the next year, Kelly shuttled back and forth to Washington, meeting with Bissell, Land, and other panel members, offering them our latest designs and radar test data, often returning dejected by rumors that Convair's proposals promised better performance and radar cross-section data than ours, even though our first preliminary design drawing looked terrific. It was designated A-1 and showed a striking single-seat two-engine airplane, a long, sleek, bullet-shaped fuselage with rounded inlets on big engines mounted on the tip of small delta wings that were two-thirds of the way back on the fuselage. One look, and even a schoolboy would realize that this bird was designed for blazing speed. But the president was less interested in performance and more intent on pushing for the lowest radar cross-section possible. It wasn't that he just didn't want to get us shot down. He didn't want the Russians to know we were even up there. Kelly argued with Washington that our tremendous height and speed advantages were the most potent factors in making us difficult to detect. But the White House and the CIA were not mollified, so we decided to apply radar-absorbing ferrites and plastics to all the airplane's leading edges, a first in military aviation. We kept the twin tails as small as possible and decided to try to construct them entirely with radar-absorbing composites. a significant technological breakthrough if we could actually do it. But hiding this airplane seemed impossible. The tremendous heat generated in supersonic flight made infrared detection inevitable. How do you hide a meteor? Our Mach 3 airplane would streak across the sky like a flaming arrow. About 6 months into the design phase, I could see discouragement clouding Kelly's big round face. Our design was now numbered A-10, and we still were not achieving lower radar cross-section results than Convair, according to Dick Bissell. So in late March 1959, we began a series of almost around-the-clock brainstorming sessions to review all our previous work and to somehow find a design that would elude Soviet radar. But it seemed fruitless, and Kelly invited Bissell and a couple of agency radar experts to Burbank for what was to be a showdown Where We Stand meeting. He asked me and two others from the design team to sit in and lend him moral support. The meeting was tense and somber. Kelly was typically candid. "We've put in 6 months of intensive design and study, and by God, we know what we're doing. But we will never get to the point where the president will be happy with the results. I'm convinced that current improvements in Russian radar will allow them to detect any airplane built in the next 3 to 5 years. Radar technology is far ahead of anti-radar technology, and we're just going to have to live with that fact. We'll never achieve the zero degree of visibility the president seems so stuck on. That technology is way beyond what we know how to do at this point. Maybe Convair can deliver it for you, but we can't." Not much more was said, and when the CIA officials left, Kelly said to us, "Well, boys, I think we're out. Ike wants an airplane from Mandrake the Magician." But later he took me aside. "Keep after this, Ben. Maybe Land or someone else will get Ike to see the light." We kept working, mostly because it was an unusually slack period at the Skunk Works, without too many other competing distractions. By design A-11 in May 1959, we felt we had scored a breakthrough in dramatically lowering the radar cross-section of the aircraft. One of the structural designers presented the idea of modifying the bullet-shaped fuselage by adding a chine, a lateral downward-sloped surface that gave the fuselage an almost cobra-like appearance. Now the underbelly of the airplane was flat, and the radar cross-section had magically decreased by an incredible 90%. By July, we decided to lay out a final revised drawing of the entire airplane, making full use of the new chine configuration. In those days, I shared an office with four others working on the new airplane, aerodynamicist Dick Fuller, two others who did performance and stability control, and my own sidekick in propulsion, a brilliant 24-year-old Caltech grad named David Campbell, an aerothermodynamicist. Dave was destined for true greatness, but only 2 years later, during his daily 2-mile jog, he dropped dead from a massive coronary. He was only 26 years old. I was separated by a connecting doorway from the office of four structures guys who configured the strength, loads, and weight of the airplane from preliminary design sketches. They put skin and muscle onto the original design concept. After lunch, one blazing summer afternoon, the aerodynamics group in my office began talking through the open door to the structures bunch about calculations on the center of pressures on the fuselage. But suddenly I got the idea of unhinging the door between us, laying the door between a couple of desks, tacking onto it a long sheet of paper, and having all of us join in designing the optimum final design to make full use of the chines. My object was simple. I said, "We're never going to get this design 100% right. We could play around forever, but I think we now know enough to nail it down at 80%, and that's plenty good enough." One of the participants later wisecracked that it was like the Russian and American soldiers joining up on the banks of the Elbe River during the last days of World War II. It took us a day and a half. Ed Baldwin did the basic design and Ed Martin the systems. Henry Combs and Ray McHenry did the structures. Merv Heal figured the weights and Lorne Cass the loads. Dan Zuck designed the cockpit and Dave Robertson handled the fuel system requirements. Dave Campbell and I weighed in with propulsion, and Dick Fuller and Dick Cantrell with the aerodynamics. Everyone chipped in with changes and modifications from previous designs. The airplane weighed 96,000 pounds without fuel, keeping it light to maximize fuel consumption and minimize cost, and was 108 feet long, with an extremely thin double delta wing attached at mid-fuselage. The wing edge was designed so razor thin that it could actually cut a mechanic's hand. We took the long sheet of paper to Kelly Johnson and unrolled it on his desk. We told him, "Kelly, everything is now exactly where it should be. The engines, the inlets, the twin tails. This is probably as close to the best we can come up with." It was our 12th design, number A-12, which would later become its official CIA project designation. Kelly took the design and ran with it to Washington. Throughout midsummer 1959, he shuttled back and forth to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, nearly a dozen times, meeting with Bissell, Land, Alan Dulles, and others, noting at one point in his private journal, "There is a good deal of concern that Speedy Gonzales, Ike, will cancel. Too expensive." But the deal was finally nailed on August 28th. "Saw Mr. Bissell alone. He told me that we had the project and that Convair was out of the picture. The agency accepts our conditions that our method of doing business will be identical to that of the U-2. Mr. Bissell agreed very firmly to this latter condition and said that unless it was done this way, he wanted nothing to do with the project either. He and Alan Dulles stated following conditions. 1. We must exercise the greatest possible ingenuity, an honest effort in the field of radar. 2. The degree of security on this project is, if possible, even tighter than on the U-2. And 3. We should make no large commitments. Large meaning in terms of millions of dollars. We were being funded to build 5 A-12 spy planes over the next 2 years at a quoted price of $96.6 million. God help us. We were in business. The CIA codenamed the project Oxcart, an oxymoron to end all. At Mach 3, our spy plane would zip across the skies faster than a high-velocity rifle bullet. Kelly had sold the idea brilliantly, but now it was up to us peons to deliver the goods. One of the great strengths of the place was the combined experience of Kelly's most senior and trusted engineers and designers, who, among other attributes, were walking parts catalogs. But suddenly we were all operating in the dark, struggling by trial and error like Cro-Magnons trying to look beyond the cooking fire to the first steam engine. All the fundamentals of building a conventional airplane were suddenly obsolete. Even the standard aluminum airframe was now useless. Aluminum lost its strength at 300 degrees Fahrenheit, which for our Mach 3 airplane was barely breaking a sweat. At the nose, the heat would be 800 degrees, hotter than a soldering iron, 1200 degrees on the engine cowlings, and 620 degrees on the cockpit windshield, which was hot enough to melt lead. About the only material capable of sustaining that kind of ferocious heat was stainless steel. For security and convenience, Kelly kept those of us working on his airplane jammed together in one corner of our old Building 82, a remnant of the bomber factory from World War II, in which we had built the U-2 and the F-104 Starfighter before it. From the original 4 he had approached on this project, we had now grown to a modest 50 or so, seated at back-to-back desks, where, like the early U-2 days, privacy surrendered to incessant kibitzing, teasing, brainstorming, and harassment. Some wag hung the sign, "Privacy sucks." My three-man thermodynamics and propulsion group now shared space with the performance and stability control people. Through a connecting door was the eight-man structures group, who designed the strength and load characteristics of the airplane. Their dean was that irascible genius Henry Combs, who had been with Kelly since World War II, and helped him build the classic two-engine P-38 Lightning Interceptor. Henry and I could have reached through the doorway and shaken hands. And, of course, he relished offering his unsolicited advice and opinions to the young whippersnapper running thermodynamics and propulsion. "Ben Rich," he teased, "how in hell do you propose getting our stainless steel monstrosity up to speed at Mach 3? You'll need inlets the size of the Holland Tunnel." Then he chuckled sardonically. Of course, Henry was no happier with the prospect of building a steel airplane than I was. More weight meant more internal support structure, more fuel, less range, and less altitude. Back in 1951, he had recommended to Kelly that we use a rare alloy called titanium for the white-hot exhaust nozzles on the afterburner of the Super